A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
A plane lands, the parking brake sets, and the clock starts ticking. 20 minutes later, that same aircraft is pushing back from the gate, fully fueled, cleaned, catered, and boarding a fresh load of passengers. Meanwhile, somewhere on a racing circuit, a Formula One car screams into the pit lane at 80 kilometers an hour. 1.82 seconds later, it's gone again. Four new tires on, front wing adjusted, 21 people having done exactly one thing each, and vanished from the hot zone. Daniel sent us this one, and the question is deceptively simple. What do these two operations share, and what can we actually learn from them?
The answer is not speed. That's the first thing to get out of the way. Speed is the output, not the input. What's actually happening in both cases is a specific kind of organizational intelligence that most teams never get close to.
You could throw more people at a gate turn or a pit stop, and you'd make it slower, not faster. That's the tell.
So let's get into what these two procedures actually look like, because the details are where the principles live. The airline turn, we're talking about the window from parking brake set to parking brake released. At carriers like Ryanair and Southwest, the target is 20 to 25 minutes. You've got somewhere between 12 and 18 ground crew roles involved. Marshaller guiding the aircraft in. Chalkers putting the blocks on the wheels. Baggage loaders front and rear. Cabin cleaners, usually a team of 4 to 6. Laboratory service vehicle. Pushback driver at the end. And someone coordinating all of it. The turn coordinator, standing at a specific vantage point with a tablet running a real-time checklist.
That's the person who's essentially the conductor. Nobody touches anything without that role knowing about it.
And then you flip over to the F1 pit stop. At an elite team like Red Bull Racing, you're looking at 20-plus crew members. For each wheel, you've got three people, a gunner operating the wheel gun, a remover pulling the old tire off, a fitter putting the new one on. That's 12 people just on the wheels. Then you've got front and rear jackmen lifting the car, a stabilizer keeping it steady, and the release mechanism. Used to be a lollipop man physically standing there with a sign, but most teams switched to a traffic light system after 2010 to eliminate human reaction time from the release decision.
The lollipop man was basically a human being functioning as a bit in a logic gate, which is a terrible job description.
The record, by the way, is 1.82 seconds. Red Bull Racing, 2023. Four tires changed, car back on the ground and released. That's not a blur, that's a system. Each crew member practices their single role more than 800 times per season.
Here's what I find interesting about putting these two side by side. One is 20 minutes, the other is under 2 seconds. One operates in a chaotic commercial airport with weather and passengers and air traffic control. The other operates in a controlled racing environment with identical conditions every time. And yet the underlying design logic is almost identical. That's the thing worth understanding.
And the stakes are real in both cases. A delayed turn at a high-frequency base like Dublin or Stansted doesn't just make one flight late. It cascades through the entire day's schedule. Missed slot times, aircraft out of position, crew timing out. Same thing in F1, a 2/10 delay in a pit stop can drop a driver from 1st to 5th. These are zero-defect environments where a single second compounds into enormous downstream cost.
Neither of these systems is actually perfect. F1 teams have bad stops in roughly 2% of pit visits. Airlines have delayed turns in 5 to 10% of flights. The goal isn't perfection, it's recovery speed. How fast can you absorb the error and keep going?
That's a crucial point, and we'll come back to it. But the thing to establish up front is what these procedures are not. They are not about individual speed. The fastest wheel gunner in the world is useless if he's not synchronized with the jackmen and the release signal. They are not about working harder. They're about parallelization and sequencing. The fuel truck and the baggage loader literally cannot occupy the same physical space at the same time, so the choreography matters more than raw effort.
They are not about decision-making at the point of execution. That's the thesis I want to plant right here. Both of these procedures are designed to eliminate decisions in the moment. When the car hits the pit box, nobody is thinking, what should I do now? When the plane sets the parking brake, nobody is improvising. Every motion, every position, every hand signal is predetermined. The thinking happened weeks or months ago, in the design of the procedure itself.
That's the organizational intelligence we're talking about. It's not the intelligence of any individual crew member. It's the intelligence embedded in the system. And that's what makes it transferable, because you can embed that same kind of intelligence in a software deployment procedure, an incident response runbook, an onboarding process. The domain doesn't matter. The principles do.
Let's unpack those principles. How do you actually coordinate 20 people to do 20 different things in a space the size of a living room or the space next to an airplane without anyone colliding, hesitating, or waiting for someone else to finish first?
The first mechanism is role granularity, the one job principle. In an F1 pit stop, nobody touches more than one component. The wheel gunner doesn't look at the car, he looks only at the nut. The remover doesn't touch the gun. The fitter doesn't touch the old tire. Each person's world shrinks to exactly one physical action. In the airline turn, same thing. The fueler does not handle bags. The lavatory truck operator does not assist with catering. The cabin cleaners do not touch the cargo hold.
This is the opposite of how most organizations think about staffing. The instinct is to hire generalists who can pitch in and wear multiple hats. But in a high-reliability procedure, that flexibility is a liability. Every time you context switch, you introduce a decision point. Should I help with bags or finish the fuel first? That half-second of hesitation is exactly what these systems are designed to eliminate.
There's a cognitive benefit, too. When your role is that narrow, you can achieve a level of automaticity that's impossible if you're juggling three tasks. The wheel gunner's hands know what to do before his brain does. That's muscle memory built through hundreds of repetitions of exactly one motion. You can't build that if you're also learning to operate the jack and check tire pressures.
The second mechanism is physical choreography. Space itself becomes a coordination tool. F1 pit stops are rehearsed on a mock pit box with tape markings for every foot placement. Every crew member knows exactly where to stand, exactly when to move, exactly which path to take to avoid colliding with someone else. The layout enforces the sequence. You literally cannot be in the wrong place because the physical constraints prevent it.
Airlines use the same principle. The turn coordinator stands at a specific vantage point, usually near the nose of the aircraft, where they can see every service vehicle and crew member. Hand signals and standardized gestures replace verbal communication because shouting across a tarmac is slow and error-prone. The baggage loader approaches from the right side because the fuel truck is on the left, and those positions never change. The catering truck has a designated window. Everyone's physical position is part of the procedure.
There's something almost beautiful about that. You don't need to tell people what to do if the space tells them what to do. It's like designing a kitchen, where the workflow is determined by where the counters and appliances are placed. You don't need a sign saying chop vegetables here. The cutting board is there, and the trash bin is underneath it, and the stove is to your right. The layout is the instruction.
The third mechanism is what I'd call the point of no return. In F1, it's the traffic light system. Every crew member completes their task and signals readiness. The system waits until all 20-plus signals are green, then releases the car in a single instant. Before that moment, everything is preparation. After it, everything is execution. There is no middle ground, no partial release, no almost done, give me one more second.
In aviation, the pushback clearance serves the same function. The cockpit requests pushback. The turn coordinator confirms all ground services are complete, bags loaded, fuel cap secured, cargo door closed, jet bridge retracted. Only then does the pushback driver get the signal. It's a binary readiness check. Either everything is go or nothing moves. No partial completion allowed.
This is where a lot of real-world procedures fall apart. They allow for mostly done. Someone says, the deployment is basically ready, let's just push and fix the config on the fly. And that's how you get a cross-threaded nut at 200 miles an hour. The point of no return has to be absolute.
The fourth mechanism is the one I find most interesting, Error recovery is a design feature, not an afterthought. F1 teams don't pretend bad stops won't happen. They train for them. A cross-threaded nut has a specific recovery protocol. A dropped wheel has a specific recovery protocol. The crew rehearses these failures exactly like they rehearse the perfect stop. The goal isn't to avoid every possible error. It's to make errors survivable.
Airlines have what they call irregular operations, playbooks. A bag is late. A passenger needs to be deplaned. The lavatory truck breaks down. Each of these has a pre-written response that doesn't require the turn coordinator to invent a solution on the spot. The thinking has already been done. The coordinator just selects the right playbook and executes.
That's a profound inversion of how most teams handle failure. The typical approach is to write the happy path procedure and then, when something goes wrong, rely on someone senior to handle it. But in these systems, the failure modes are treated as part of the procedure itself. They're not exceptions, they're branches.
That connects to the fifth mechanism, which is procedural compression. Both systems are ruthless about removing non-essential motion and communication. In an F1 pit stop, crew members don't speak during the stop. They use hand signals. Verbal communication is the slowest and most error-prone channel, so it's eliminated entirely during execution. In aviation, ground crews use standardized marshalling gestures and headset communication with the cockpit, again, minimizing verbal exchanges to only what's absolutely necessary.
Think about how much of a typical team's coordination is just people talking to each other. Are you done? Should I start? Wait, not yet. Every one of those exchanges is a point of failure. These procedures replace conversation with choreography. You don't ask if the wheel is on. You signal with your hand, and the system reads the signal.
Those are the five core mechanisms. Role granularity, one person, one job. Physical choreography, the space enforces the sequence, the point of no return, a binary go or no-go trigger. Error recovery as design. Failures are planned for, not improvised around. And procedural compression, removing every motion and word that isn't strictly necessary.
Here's where it gets interesting. Those mechanisms are the how. But the knock-on effect, the things that happen when you actually build procedures this way, are where the real lessons live. Because it turns out that how you practice, how you measure, and how much slack you build in are just as important as the procedure itself.
F1 teams practice pit stops every race weekend, sometimes 50 or more stops in a single practice session. Over a season, that's hundreds of repetitions per crew member. Airlines run turn simulations and training facilities with mock aircraft cabins and baggage systems. The procedure is not the document, the procedure is the muscle memory.
That completely inverts the typical corporate approach where someone writes an SOP, puts it in a shared drive, and assumes it's being followed. The document is not the procedure. The document is a description of the procedure. The actual procedure lives in the bodies of the people executing it, and it only gets there through repetition.
There's a measurement paradox here, too. Both industries measure everything. F1 teams track individual wheel-off times per crew member per stop. Airlines track turn time by station down to the minute. But both have learned that measuring too granularly creates perverse incentives. If you measure baggage handlers on seconds per bag, they'll skip safety checks. If you measure wheel gunners on speed alone, they'll rush and cross-thread a nut.
The solution is to measure the system output. Total turn time, total pit stop time, and use individual metrics only for coaching, not for evaluation. The airline doesn't care if the fueler was fast, it cares if the plane left on time. Individual data is for improving the system, not for ranking people.
That's a hard lesson for a lot of organizations to learn. The instinct is to measure everything and optimize every subcomponent. But optimizing subcomponents independently usually degrades the system as a whole. That's a well-known principle in systems thinking, but it's painfully hard to implement in practice.
Then there's the slack question. F1 pit stops have essentially zero slack. Every motion is optimized to the millisecond. But airline turns deliberately build in 2 to 3 minutes of buffer. Because airlines operate in an uncontrolled environment. Weather, passenger behavior, air traffic control, delays. These are unpredictable. F1 operates in a controlled environment where the variables are known. The optimal amount of slack in a procedure is inversely proportional to the predictability of the operating environment.
That's a principle that almost nobody applies correctly. Teams either over-optimize for a chaotic environment and burn out, or they build so much slack into a stable environment that they're leaving performance on the table. The right amount of slack depends on how much uncertainty you're actually facing.
What does all this mean for the kind of teams our listeners are on? Software deployments, incident response, onboarding processes. The pit stop principle can be applied to any multi-person procedure. The key is to identify the critical path task, the one thing everything else depends on, and make that the single point of coordination. Everything else runs in parallel, not in sequence.
Most incident response procedures fail because they try to be both diagnostic and remedial simultaneously. One person is running commands while also trying to figure out what's wrong. The airline and F1 model separates assess from act. The turn coordinator assesses. The ground crew acts. The race engineer assesses. The pit crew acts. In incident management, this is the same principle as the swarming model. One person coordinates, everyone else executes a predefined role.
A typical software deployment has one person running commands while others watch. A pit stop deployment would assign one person to database migrations, one to config changes, one to monitoring verification, all coordinated by a single deploy lead who does not touch any system. The deploy lead is the turn coordinator. Their job is to see the whole picture and make the single go or no-go call.
This maps directly onto what major cloud providers have already figured out. The incident command systems at places like AWS and Google use exactly this structure. The incident commander does not debug. Debugging is done by role-assigned responders who each own one piece of the investigation. The commander's only job is to maintain the picture and make the release decision.
If we're pulling out concrete takeaways, and this is what Daniel was really asking for, I'd say there are four. First, design procedures around the one decision principle. Identify the single binary go or no-go point in your process and make everything else subordinate to it. Everything before that point is preparation. Everything after is execution. No mid-procedure decision-making.
Second, rehearse. Don't just document. The difference between a procedure that works and one that doesn't is the number of times it's been practiced under realistic conditions. Schedule turn simulations for your critical procedures. Run them with a timer, with observers, with the expectation of failure. If you haven't practiced it, you don't actually have a procedure. You have a wish.
Third, measure system output, not individual speed. The airline doesn't care if the fueler was fast. It cares if the plane left on time. Individual metrics are for coaching, not evaluation. If you must measure individuals, do it privately and use it to improve the system, not to rank people against each other.
Fourth, build slack proportional to environmental unpredictability. If your operating environment is stable, optimize for speed. If it's chaotic, optimize for resilience. The mistake is applying the wrong model. Running a chaotic operation like a pit stop with zero buffer, or running a predictable one with so much slack that you're wasting capacity.
Next time you see a plane push back exactly on time, or watch an F1 car disappear from the pit box in under 2 seconds, remember, that's not speed, that's design. Those 21 people didn't move faster than humanly possible. They moved exactly as fast as the system allowed, because the system removed every obstacle, every hesitation, every unnecessary decision. The question is, what procedure in your own work would benefit from being treated like a pit stop? And what would it take to reduce your turn time by 50%?
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1960s, a missionary working near Lake Tanganyika documented the last known practitioner of a dyeing technique that produced a deep crimson from the roots of a specific riverside shrub. The recipe required soaking the crushed roots in fermented milk for 3 days before boiling the cloth. And the missionary's handwritten notes are the only surviving record of the process.
If you have a weird prompt you'd like us to explore, send it to show@myweirdprompts.com. We read everyone. This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Go find a procedure and rehearse it. Let's start by understanding what these two procedures actually involve, because they're more similar than you might think, and the differences are where the real lessons live. The airline turn. We're talking about the sequence from parking brake set to parking brake released. At carriers like Ryanair and Southwest, the target is 20 to 25 minutes.
That's not just aspirational. Ryanair hits a 25-minute average across its entire network, and at high-frequency bases like Dublin and Stansted, they're pushing for 20. That's a full narrow-body aircraft, emptied, cleaned, restocked, refueled, and reboarded, in less time than it takes to watch a sitcom.
The cast involved is substantial. You've got somewhere between 12 and 18 ground crew roles, a marshaller guiding the aircraft onto the stand, chockers putting blocks on the wheels the moment it stops, the fueler connecting the hose. That's a single person, by the way, and they're working with 30,000 liters of jet fuel. Baggage loaders at the front and rear cargo holds, typically two per hold. A cabin cleaning crew of 4 to 6 people moving through the aisle in a choreographed sweep, the catering truck replacing galley carts, a lavatory service vehicle, and at the end, the pushback driver ready to tow the aircraft off the stand.
The turn coordinator standing at a specific vantage point, usually near the nose, running a real-time checklist on a tablet, watching every one of those rolls, and making the single call on when pushback happens. That person is not doing any of the physical work. Their entire job is to see the whole picture.
Now flip to the F1 pit stop. At an elite team like Red Bull Racing, you're looking at 20-plus crew members. For each wheel, 3 people. A gunner operating the pneumatic wheel gun, a remover pulling the old tire off, a fitter slotting the new one on. That's 12 people just on the wheels. Then you've got front and rear jackmen, 2 people lifting the entire car in a fraction of a second, a stabilizer keeping it from wobbling, and the release mechanism. Used to be a lollipop man physically standing there with a sign, but most teams switched to a traffic light system after 2010 to strip human reaction time out of the release decision entirely.
The lollipop man was a human being functioning as a logic gate, which is a terrible job description, but an elegant piece of engineering when you think about it, until they realized a computer could do it faster.
The record is 1.82 seconds, Red Bull Racing 2023. 4 tires changed, car dropped back to the ground, driver released. Each crew member practices their single role more than 800 times per season. That's not athleticism, that's procedural density. 21 people doing 21 different things simultaneously in a space the size of a living room, none of them colliding.
Here's what makes the comparison worth doing. One procedure takes 20 minutes in an uncontrolled commercial environment, with weather and passengers and air traffic control. The other takes under 2 seconds in a tightly controlled racing environment, and yet the underlying design logic is nearly identical. Both are zero-defect environments where a single second of delay compounds into major downstream costs. Missed slot times, aircraft out of position, crew timing out, or a driver dropping from first to fifth because a wheel nut cross-threaded.
Both are systems designed to eliminate decision-making at the point of execution. That's the thesis. When the car hits the pit box, nobody is thinking about what to do. When the plane sets the parking brake, nobody is improvising. Every motion, every position, every hand signal was decided weeks or months ago. The thinking is baked into the design of the procedure itself. The first mechanism is roll granularity, what I think of as the one job principle. In an F1 pit stop, nobody touches more than one component. The wheel gunner doesn't look at the car, he looks only at the nut. His entire world during those 2 seconds is a single fastener. The remover doesn't touch the gun, the fitter doesn't touch the old tire. Each person's cognitive load shrinks to exactly one physical action, repeated until it's automatic.
The airline turn does the same thing. The fueler does not handle bags. The lavatory truck operator does not assist with catering. The cabin cleaners do not go near the cargo hold. You'd think cross-training would make things faster. Someone finishes early and jumps in to help. But that's exactly wrong. The moment someone switches tasks, they introduce a decision point. Should I help with the bags or finish the fuel first? That half-second hesitation is what these systems are designed to eliminate.
There's a cognitive depth to this that's easy to miss. When your role is that narrow, you can achieve a level of automaticity that's impossible if you're juggling 3 tasks. The wheel gunner's hands know what to do before his brain does. That's muscle memory built through hundreds of repetitions of exactly one motion. You can't build that if you're also learning to operate the jack and check tire pressures. This specialization isn't about efficiency. It's about removing the brain from the loop during execution.
Which is the opposite of how most organizations think about staffing. The instinct is to hire people who can pitch in and wear multiple hats. But in a high reliability procedure, flexibility is a liability. Every hat you might wear is a decision you might have to make.
The second mechanism is physical choreography. Space itself becomes a coordination tool. F1 pit stops are rehearsed on a mock pit box with tape markings for every foot placement. Every crew member knows exactly where to stand, when to move, which path to take to avoid colliding with someone else. The layout enforces the sequence. You literally cannot be in the wrong place because the physical constraints prevent it.
Airlines use the same principle. The turn coordinator stands at a specific vantage point, usually near the nose of the aircraft, where they can see every service vehicle and crew member. The baggage loader approaches from the right side because the fuel truck is on the left, and those positions never change. The catering truck has a designated window that corresponds to the galley door. Everyone's physical position is part of the procedure. You don't need to tell people where to go if the layout tells them.
Both systems minimize verbal communication for the same reason. In an F1 pit stop, crew members don't speak during the stop. They use hand signals. The rear jackman raises a hand when the car is up. Each wheel gunner signals when the nut is torqued. The traffic light system reads all signals and releases the car. Verbal communication is the slowest and most error-prone channel, so it's eliminated entirely during execution.
Think about how much of a typical team's coordination is just people talking. Are you done? Should I start? Wait, not yet. Every one of those exchanges is a point of failure. These procedures replace conversation with choreography. You don't ask if the wheel is on. You signal with your hand, and the system reads the signal.
The third mechanism is what I'd call the point of no return. In F1, it's the traffic light. Every crew member completes their task and signals readiness. The system waits until all 20-plus signals are green, then releases the car in a single instant. Before that moment, everything is preparation. After it, everything is execution. There is no middle ground.
In aviation, pushback clearance serves the same function. The cockpit requests pushback. The turn coordinator confirms all ground services are complete. Bags loaded, fuel cap secured, cargo door closed, jet bridge retracted. Only then does the pushback driver get the signal. It's a binary readiness check. Either everything is go or nothing moves. No partial completion allowed.
This is where a lot of real-world procedures fall apart. They allow for mostly done. Someone says the deployment is basically ready. Let's just push and fix the config on the fly. And that's how you get a cross-threaded nut at 200 miles an hour. The point of no return has to be absolute, and it has to be a single decision, not a negotiation.
The fourth mechanism is the one I find most interesting. Error recovery as a designed feature, not an afterthought. F1 teams don't pretend bad stops won't happen. They train for them. A cross-threaded nut has a specific recovery protocol. A dropped wheel has a specific recovery protocol. The crew rehearses these failures exactly like they rehearse the perfect stop. The goal isn't to avoid every possible error. It's to make errors survivable.
Airlines have what they call irregular operations playbooks. A bag is late. A passenger needs to be deplaned. The lavatory truck breaks down. Each of these has a pre-written response that doesn't require the turn coordinator to invent a solution on the spot. The thinking has already been done. The coordinator just selects the right playbook and executes.
That inverts how most teams handle failure. The typical approach is to write the happy path procedure and then, when something goes wrong, rely on someone senior to handle it. But in these systems, the failure pattern are treated as part of the procedure itself. They're not exceptions. They're branches. The recovery is just as choreographed as the success.
That brings us to the fifth mechanism, which ties it all together. Procedural compression. Both systems are ruthless about removing non-essential motion and communication. In aviation, ground crews use standardized marshalling gestures and headset communication with the cockpit, again, minimizing verbal exchanges to only what's absolutely necessary. The turn coordinator's tablet updates in real time as each task completes, so they're not asking, "Is catering done?" They can see it.
All five mechanisms point to the same insight. These aren't procedures that people follow. They're procedures that people inhabit. The role, the space, the signals, the trigger, the recovery path. Together they form a kind of exoskeleton. The crew doesn't need to be brilliant in the moment, because the brilliance was already built into the structure they're moving inside.
Here's what I keep coming back to. All five of those mechanisms depend on something that doesn't appear in any procedure document. F1 teams run 50 or more practice pit stops in a single session on a race weekend. Over a season, each crew member executes their single role hundreds of times under realistic conditions. The car is real, the tires are real, the pressure is real. The procedure is not the document. The procedure is the muscle memory.
Airlines do the same thing. They run turn simulations in training facilities with mock aircraft cabins, baggage systems, the whole setup. A new hire doesn't read the turn procedure and then go do it. They practice it, with a timer, with observers, with the expectation of failure. The document is just the starting point. The actual procedure lives in the bodies of the people executing it.
That completely inverts the typical corporate approach. Someone writes an SOP, puts it in a shared drive, maybe does a walkthrough once, and then assumes it's being followed. But the SOP is not the procedure, it's a description of the procedure. The real procedure is a physical and cognitive pattern that only exists because people have done it enough times that it's automatic.
There's a measurement paradox that emerges from this. Both industries measure obsessively. F1 teams track individual wheel-off times per crew member per stop. Airlines track turn time by station down to the minute. But both have learned the hard way that measuring too granularly creates perverse incentives. If you measure baggage handlers on seconds per bag, they skip safety checks. If you evaluate wheel gunners on speed alone, they rush and cross-thread a nut.
The solution they've converged on is counterintuitive but consistent. Measure the system output, total turn time, total pit stop time, and use individual metrics only for coaching, never for evaluation. The airline doesn't care if the fueler was fast. It cares if the plane left on time. Individual data is for improving the system, not for ranking people against each other.
That's a hard lesson for organizations to absorb. The instinct is to measure everything and optimize every subcomponent. But optimizing subcomponents independently usually degrades the system as a whole. You make the wheel gunners faster by shaving a tenth of a second, and suddenly they're out of sync with the jackmen, and the total stop time goes up, not down.
Then there's the slack question, which is where the comparison between these two procedures gets really revealing. F1 pit stops have essentially zero slack. Every motion is optimized to the millisecond. There is no buffer. But airline turns deliberately build in 2 to 3 minutes of buffer. Why the difference?
Because F1 operates in a controlled environment. The track conditions are known. The car arrives at a predictable moment. No one is wandering into the pit box with a carry-on, asking if this is the flight to Malaga. Airlines operate in an uncontrolled environment, weather, passenger behavior, air traffic control delays. The optimal amount of slack is inversely proportional to the predictability of the operating environment.
Almost nobody applies this correctly. Teams either try to run a chaotic operation like a pit stop, zero slack, everything optimized, and they burn out the moment something unexpected happens. Or they build so much buffer into a stable, predictable process that they're leaving enormous performance on the table. The right amount of slack is a function of how much uncertainty you're actually facing, and that has to be measured honestly.
What does all this mean for the kind of teams our listeners are on? Software deployments, incident response, onboarding processes. The pit stop principle applies to any multi-person procedure. The key is to identify the critical path task, the one thing everything else depends on, and make that the single point of coordination. Everything else runs in parallel, not in sequence.
A typical software deployment has one person running commands while three others watch. A pit stop deployment would assign one person to database migrations, one to config changes, one to monitoring verification, all coordinated by a single deploy lead who does not touch any system. The deploy lead is the turn coordinator. Their only job is to see the whole picture and make the single go or no-go call.
Most incident response procedures fail because they try to be both diagnostic and remedial at the same time. One person is running commands while also trying to figure out what's wrong. The airline and F1 model separates assess from act. The turn coordinator assesses. The ground crew acts. The race engineer assesses. The pit crew acts. One brain on the picture, everyone else executing a predefined role.
This is exactly what the major cloud providers figured out with their incident command systems. The incident commander does not debug. Debugging is done by role-assigned responders who each own one piece of the investigation: networking, database, application layer. The commander's only job is to maintain the picture, manage the clock, and make the release decision. It's the swarming model, and it's structurally identical to what happens in a pit box or on a gate apron. If we're pulling out the concrete takeaways, and this is what Daniel's prompt is really driving at, I think there are four that someone could actually act on next week.
First one is the one decision principle. Find the single binary go or no-go point in your process and make everything else subordinate to it. In the pit stop, it's the traffic light. In the turn, it's pushback clearance. Everything before that moment is preparation. Everything after is execution. And the key is that nobody is allowed to be mostly done when that trigger fires. Either you're green or you're not.
Second, rehearse. Don't just document. If your team's deployment procedure exists only as a Notion page, you don't actually have a procedure. You have a wish. Schedule a turn simulation. Run the whole thing with a timer, with observers, with the explicit expectation that it will fail the first few times. The goal isn't to confirm the procedure works. The goal is to find out where it doesn't.
I'd add that the rehearsal needs to include the failure branches, not just the happy path. If you only practice the clean deployment, you're training your team to freeze when something goes wrong. Practice the bad stops. What happens if the database migration fails halfway through? Who signals what, and to whom?
Third takeaway, measure the system output, not individual speed. The airline doesn't care if the fueler was fast. It cares if the plane left on time. If you're tracking how long each engineer takes to run their migration script, you're measuring the wrong thing, and you're probably creating perverse incentives. Individual data is for coaching, in private, to improve the system, not for ranking people on a dashboard.
Fourth, build slack proportional to how unpredictable your environment actually is. If you're running a controlled process, same conditions every time, no external variables, optimize for speed. If you're operating in chaos, production incidents, customer-facing timelines, dependencies you don't control, built-in buffer. The mistake is applying the wrong model. A chaotic operation run like a pit stop breaks the moment reality intrudes. A stable operation run with too much slack leaves half your capacity unused.
The thing that ties all four together is honesty. Honesty about where your single decision point actually is. Honesty about whether you've really practiced or just written a document. Honesty about what you're measuring and why. Honesty about how much uncertainty you're actually facing. These procedures work not because they're clever, but because they're built on a clear-eyed assessment of reality.
Next time you see a plane push back exactly on time, or watch an F1 car disappear from the pit box in under 2 seconds, remember, that's not speed, that's design. Those 21 people didn't move faster than humanly possible. They moved exactly as fast as the system allowed, because the system removed every obstacle, every hesitation, every unnecessary decision. The question worth sitting with is, what procedure in your own work would benefit from being treated like a pit stop? And what would it actually take to reduce your turn time by 50%?
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1960s, a missionary working near Lake Tanganyika documented the last known practitioner of a dyeing technique that produced a deep crimson from the roots of a specific riverside shrub. The recipe required soaking the crushed roots in fermented milk for 3 days before boiling the cloth, and the missionary's handwritten notes are the only surviving record of the process.
If you have a weird prompt you'd like us to explore, send it to show@myweirdprompts.com. We read everyone. This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Go find a procedure and rehearse it.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.